Buckingham Palace says the Queen has been told her former brother-in-law has died. Relatives of Lord Snowden, who was married to the late Princess Margaret from 1960 to 1978, say he passed away peacefully, aged 86. Royal biographer Ingrid Seward says the family was always fond of the pair, even though they weren't a typical royal couple.
They were this very beautiful, glamorous couple. They were the Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton of the royal family, if you like. They were friends with the Beatles. They were at the latest nightclubs. They holidayed in the swish resorts of Sardinia.
Is there a conspiracy? Yes. Are we being manipulated and controlled and guided into a new world order and a new world religion? Yes. Is there a group in charge of this who's been in charge all along who are bringing this about? Yes. And I can tell you, folks, they're as old as man. They're the followers of an ancient religion that has persisted even unto this day.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Israeli political attaché Shai Masop doing trying to take down a British government minister on Al Jazeera? Is MI5 asleep? So why does it take a TV network from the Gulf state of Qatar to do what the London media and the security service MI5 should have been doing? Also, was all that stuff about Russia hacking the US election fake news or not? And talks about the reunification of Cyprus, healing the wounds made by the man behind the bloody Turkish invasion in the 1970s, Henry Kissinger. They hinge on energy resources. Why is that? After we reported it here, the London media finally catch up with news of Operation Atlantic Resolve. Obama shipping 2,000 tanks and 4,000 soldiers over to Europe and moving a further 1,600 tanks from Germany and hold up to the Russian border. That's nice of him, isn't it? All those promises made back in 1990 by US Secretary of State James Baker to the Russian equivalent Edward Shevardnadze, well, let's forget about it, shall we? Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM 93.2 at noon every Tuesday. This week, a look at the Muslim sects. Which believe and follow the Quran and which don't? Some of them even have their own Messiah. That's Dialect next Tuesday. You can listen again at bcfmradio.com/dialect or download it now from dialectradio.co.uk. But first, extraordinary revelations last weekend by Al Jazeera all over the Sunday papers about Israel's political attaché Shai Masot trying to, in inverted commas, take down, he said, a British government minister, a junior minister in the Ministry of Defence, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that this has come out at this time, but am I surprised? No. We know that they've been active in trying to control our politics for many, many years.
Can you explain why it's Al Jazeera over in Qatar, thousands of miles away? I think it takes about 7 hours or so to get there by airliner or whatever. Why are they doing these exposés that we used to do here in Britain on programmes like Panorama, World in Action, and people exposés like the Roger Cook, the Cook Report?
Well, because there's a very strong Zionist influence within the mainstream media in Britain, And when you talk about the intelligence services, well, they're in alliance with Mossad in Syria and other places. So in actual fact, they all know about this. It's not as if they didn't know about it. They just don't want to expose it because it doesn't suit their agenda.
So what is the purpose of trying to get rid of a government minister then?
Well, it's a general policy pursued, not just in Britain but elsewhere. Israel has a very forward, active policy of trying to intervene in the politics of states which are going to affect the situation for them. So that they're carrying on doing exactly that. All that's happened in this particular case is that they've been caught with their trousers down. But that is not... You know, that's what's interesting about this, is that Qatar have decided to pick up the cudgels. And that's possibly because Qatar and Russia are now in a rapprochement, so that the Qatari government has taken a 20% stake in Rosneft, which means that Qatar may no longer be supporting the rebels in Syria, and therefore they can go back to their more traditional policy, because they tend to be aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood, of opposing Israel, and therefore Al Jazeera is doing that job. But in any case, Al Jazeera are to be commended for doing this job. It's a job that needed doing, and they've done it, and of course other media outlets have had to pick up on it.
Well, I'm joined on the line now by former ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Thank you very much.
Craig, can you give us your view on this chap, Shai Massot, and what you think has allowed him to be in the position where a foreign media outlet is recording him in a London cafe, plotting to remove a British government minister?
Yeah, I think we should all start off by, you know, congratulating Al Jazeera on their fantastic investigatory work. And they've put to shame the British media, none of whom dare touch this subject. And Massot's overconfidence it was also astonishing. You know, obviously these people feel completely untouchable and able to go about this in the absolutely blatant way that we've all witnessed on the documentary. But there's also an additional point, of course, that I've been trying to pursue myself, which is what Massot was doing in the country in the first place, because he's not on the diplomatic staff of the embassy. He's obviously a senior person. He's, you know, seen relating directly with the ambassador. He's able to go around offering £1 million to Labour friends of Israel. And he's a former major in the army, in the navy of Israel. So he's obviously not a junior person, and yet he's not a diplomat. So there really aren't any categories that he could be in where he would be permitted to be in this country. So what was his residence status and visa status? And is the Foreign Office conniving at allowing intelligence agents of Israel residency in the UK who are not officially part of the embassy?
Yes, but I mean, Craig, Israel's an ally, so why shouldn't you call it conniving? Surely that's exactly what you do with your allies, is you're actually making arrangements with them because they are your allies.
Yeah, but you still, you know, you still control immigration. America's ally as well, but the American embassy aren't allowed to bring in any number of people they want to and employ them in the UK, nor is any other NATO country. Because, you know, being a diplomat in a country does grant employment rights and residency rights, which are quite strongly guarded by countries. I mean, neither you nor I can go live in the United States or in Israel, for that matter, because of its residency and employment requirements. So, and the Home Office in particular is always, you know, bearing down on the Foreign Office not to allow too many people attached to embassies. And each embassy has a quota, an agreed number of people they are permitted, and that number is normally reciprocal, with the British embassy in that country being allowed the same number of people. And this guy was not within the quota of the Israeli embassy. So what was he doing here?
Now, you've asked some questions of the Foreign Office over the last few days. One of them is why this chap was not on the official diplomatic list. What is the official diplomatic list, and why does it matter?
Well, each country is allowed, you know, a certain number of diplomats in the UK. So you can't send as many diplomats as you want. Otherwise, some countries, Nigeria perhaps being a good example, would suddenly send us 2,000. So each country has an agreed limit set, and that limit is normally reciprocal, and that's the diplomatic list. And then these people are openly declared as diplomats. Everyone knows who they are. Of course, being on the list brings certain entitlements, particularly to diplomatic immunity, but also tax exemption. So there are advantages to being on the diplomatic list, but they're also quite strictly controlled. And there have been periods, and it's probably still true, where some countries, for example, it used to be the case that diplomats from the Soviet Union weren't allowed to travel more than 60 miles outside London. And probably some countries still do have that kind of restriction on them. So, being a diplomat is quite a restricted and controlled thing. You have to be a named and accepted person within the number of people allowed. And he wasn't that. But the thing is, he, as a former major in the Navy and obviously a fairly senior officer in the Directorate of Strategic Affairs, he is senior to quite a lot of people who are on the diplomatic list. So he did not ought to be allowed to be here, because you're allowed two categories. You're allowed diplomats, and then you're allowed junior technical and support staff. And that's normally just a handful. Three or four would be normal in an embassy the size of the Israeli embassy. And they should be what they say they are. Basically, they're the people who maintain the IT systems, and maybe a cleaner, because they might want their own cleaner to clean the most sensitive areas of the embassy where they're liable to be secret documents. And perhaps the ambassador may, for security reasons, want a driver from his own country. Something along those lines, three or four people who are supposed to be junior technical and support staff. And that's what you're allowed. You're allowed diplomats, you're allowed technical and support staff. You're not allowed anybody else. And as Massad was neither of those, what the hell was he doing here?
So you mentioned there, you said, well, what, the London media don't dare touch this subject. Well, surely it's just that Al Jazeera has scooped them. They do dare touch it. In fact, many of them covered it.
Well, they covered it after Al Jazeera did it, because it would be very hard for them not to, because the Alan Duncan claims were so sensational. But they covered it for 24 hours and then moved on. And really, the coverage, none of them tried to move further. None of them tried to ask the kind of questions I've asked about what was he doing in the country, what is his status, were MI5 and MI6 involved in bringing him here? All the sort of follow-on questions you might ask. There's no sign at all of any digging. All the mainstream media did was give a very shortened version of the more sensational bits of what was in the Al Jazeera documentary for one day, and then they dropped it.
Now, you say there's no starker proof of the golden chains in which Israel has entangled the British political class than the incredible fact that Shai Massaud hasn't been expelled for secretly conspiring to influence British politics, attacking Britain's deputy foreign minister. What do you mean by the golden chains?
Well, essentially, they buy people. I mean, that's what's shown quite clearly. In the documentaries, they give jobs to young people who are prepared to support Israel, are then employed by the embassy as locally engaged staff. And I should say there's no limit on the number of locally engaged staff you can have. If people who are British citizens or European Union citizens and entitled to be here already, they can employ as many as they want as locally engaged staff. And they offer those kind of jobs, and then they offer jobs, paid jobs, in a number of other pro-Israel lobbying groups like BICOM or what have you, and then and essentially career progression. And they, all expenses paid, luxury sea trips to Israel, and this £1 million for the labour friends of Israel that was offered. And it's not exactly plain, precisely where all that money would be going. So they essentially buy the loyalty of politicians. And that's why there's no doubt at all that the vast majority of members of parliament are members of one of the Friends of Israel group and are much more supportive of Israel and much more hostile to the Palestinians than the general run of the population. And that's why they're bought.
The There's also, I mean, there's a reluctance to cover the Israeli subject. We've seen recently, for example, Ken Livingstone being expelled from the Labour Party for saying something which actually, if you look at it, is actually a historical fact. Hitler did do deals with the Zionists. What do you think the role of attacking people for being anti-Semitic has played in all this? Because it does seem that seems to be a term which is thrown around rather too often. In fact, there's even been attempts to change what it means officially by the British government.
Yeah, well, I think there's undoubtedly been, and again, if you control the political class and are prepared to put enough money into it, you can get changes like that made. You can get committees of the European Union to declare that being hostile to the state of Israel equals anti-Semitism, even though plainly that's nothing to do with what the word generally means. And the difficulty is, of course, that because of European history, because of the Holocaust, anti-Semitism is a terrible charge. Everybody is quite rightly terrified to be called an anti-Semite because it's a dreadful thing to be. It's like being called a paedophile or something like that. It's a charge that's so toxic that it terrifies people. It was being bandied about and used, of course, as an attack weapon against Jeremy Corbyn, trying to associate really pretty well everyone close to Jeremy Corbyn with anti-Semitism, often on the basis of no evidence whatsoever, including, for example, the accusations against the Labour Club at Oxford University, where the only evidence they were anti-Semitic was that they supported the Israeli Apartheid Week, which is a campaigning time period, on many campuses where pro-Palestinian activists explain the similarities between Israel and apartheid South Africa. That doesn't make you anti-Semitic, but that was the entire basis of a story which really had much more play in the mainstream media than this Shay Massot story has had.
Now, you mentioned that £1 million slush fund. Is there actually any real evidence for that? Or was he could just have been boasting, couldn't he?
He could just have been boasting, but it seems most improbable because, the other things which they do happen. When they offer people jobs, they get the jobs and they get paid. When they offer to send people to Israel, they get to Israel and everything's paid for them. It's all paid plush and all expenses paid. So, for everything else he's been doing, it's real and the money is there. So I see no reason to doubt that the money was really there for that one too.
Now, it does maybe have some similarities with the affair over Adam Werrity a few years ago, which ended up with our local MP here from North Somerset, Liam Fox, being sacked as Defence Secretary, because it was really only up until the point where this became discussed widely in the press, the existence of this guy who was very closely linked to the Israeli government, Adam Werrity, that it was only through press embarrassment that finally he was forced out. I mean, surely this is the job, isn't it, of people behind the scenes to make sure these kinds of embarrassing situations don't occur, make the headlines around the world, before the British government seem to be doing anything about it?
You would think so. You would think so. And I should commiserate with you. I had no idea you were unfortunate enough to have Liam Fox as your MP. That's very unlucky. But, the Werrity thing was very interesting because the media treated it all, the mainstream media treated it all as a bit of a joke, as though the only real question was whether Liam Fox and Adam Werrity were lovers. Whereas, in fact, of course, it ran much deeper than that. It wasn't just a matter of Liam Fox having a close friend or boyfriend with security passes and things. He was actually working almost entirely on matters concerning Israel, and he'd been with Liam Fox at a number of meetings in Israel itself, at the Hezilia conference in Israel, at the We Believe in Israel conference in the UK, and they'd had eight in total meetings in secret with our ambassador to Israel, Matthew Gould, including two or three before he became ambassador. It's documented, and the Cabinet Office confirmed in reply to a question from Paul Flynn MP But at some of the meetings with Gould, Wellity and Fox all present, Mossad were also there. So, you know, that was what was really happening in the Adam Wellity case. And yet the independent newspaper was the only British mainstream media outlet which mentioned Israel in relation to the Adam Wellity. I'm not being quite there. Eventually the Daily Mail caught up and they did as well. But you know, it hardly got a mention. And the vast majority of people who remember the Adam Wellity scandal only remember it as something to do with whether or not Liam Fox had a gay lover, not to do with Israel. Vast majority of people don't realise that's what it was about at all.
Well, the Israel lobby certainly seems quite powerful. Many Palestinians crying out around the world saying, well, look, why is nobody looking at what's going on here? This is just as bad as South Africa and in some ways worse too. And we've just had Donald Trump appointing a pro-settlement, I believe it's a, I'm not sure if it's either the ambassador to Israel or else a secretary of state that he's appointing. What is there anything you think that's going to actually break this kind of, you called them golden cords, I suppose, they also exist between Israel, Britain and the United States, because it seems that Israel is totally dependent on those sorts of support from, we're getting from the US and Britain. And also that support that we're giving to Israel is really bringing Britain down in the eyes of the world. It's making us look like we're supporting right-wing government in Israel and a racist government, and it's actually bad for Britain's reputation around the world.
Yeah, no, that's true. We've on several occasions, you know, stuck our neck out to join the Americans in vetoing the resolutions of the United Nations Security Council, and that adds to the dislike of the UK throughout the world, although, and I should say, as a former colonial power, there's quite a lot of dislike already. It's not the only reason the UK is disliked, and I think very often what people do, that they have this cozy view that, you know, former colonial countries think fondly of their former imperial masters, whereas, of course, in fact, they were enslaved, imprisoned, raped, deprived of resources, and many of them, you know, many people there resent it deeply. So, yes, it certainly does nothing for Biden's reputation internationally, but I wouldn't start from the position that Biden has a good reputation in the first place.
There's also disclosures at the beginning of the week in The Guardian that this guy Massot from the Israeli embassy was also attempting to influence Labour affairs, the opposition too, by establishing new political groups, he said, likely to enrage Jeremy Corbyn, who's already characterised the threat to take down MPs as a serious national security issue. So what about this attempt to influence Labour too? Is this what people like this do? I mean, it doesn't even sound like he's got any kind of official status, but it seems that he's got large amounts of money in order to really steer politics, both sides of the chamber.
Well, I think that's true, but I mean, I think he is doing nothing any different to what Israel has been doing for the last 30 years. I don't think this is new. It's simply that they happen to have been, you know, caught out by this very, very clever sting by Al Jazeera. But you know, there have been many people like him before, and there'll be many people like him again in future. There seems no stigma attached to being a member of the conservative Friends of Israel and going on three five-star trips to Israel. You know, politicians appear to have no shame, and I suppose that so many of them, you know, it's so much the norm, and the majority of people in the House of Commons do it, that within their own little Westminster bubble, they don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Okay, just changing the subject to talk about Trump, because he's come out this week. It looks as if, I don't know whether it's just that he hadn't seen the right documents by the CIA or anything else, but he's now saying, of course, it was Russia that hacked the US elections, or at least hacked into the Hillary Clinton and the Podesta, got those Podesta emails out there. Do you think what do you think is behind this? Because I know you were involved to a certain extent with all this, Craig.
I don't think he's exactly saying that. He said one sentence that could be interpreted that way, which the press had rather jumped on, but in among 50 or 60 other things he said, which could be predicted.
Well, he says it was Russia. That seems to be pretty clear.
Yeah, he does, but he's also, on at least 30 occasions, said it wasn't Russia. And with Trump, there is probably no subject at all, it's probably not a single subject, on which you can't find contradictory statements by Trump at different times. So I think to leap on the one time he said something one way, I mean, since that, he said the entire dossier which has been produced, detailing how he colluded with Russia and how Russia hacked, he said it's all nonsense and false news. So I genuinely don't pay any attention to the one time he conceded it was Russia. I think he just thought that was a tactical thing to concede, rather than the fact he really believes it, and he was trying to see whether anything could be done to mend relations with the intelligence agencies. And he since comes to the conclusion that nothing can be done, and that they're liars are out to get him, and he's changed tack again. So I don't. I really don't put much weight on him saying it was Russia. It wasn't Russia. But what is undoubtedly true is that I've got no doubt that Russian hackers at some stage have attempted to hack both the DNC and Podesta. Russian hackers have attempted to hack my own blog servers on dozens of occasions. And anybody who's never received a phishing email from a Russian hacking group is extremely lucky, because this kind of thing happens all the time. But it doesn't mean that it was Russian hackers who got the particular emails that were passed on to WikiLeaks. Because if they had done, the NSA would have precise evidence. You know, the NSA would have the ability to actually see those exact very emails being transmitted. And the NSA have never, ever made that claim, nor have they ever claimed that they have evidence of those emails being transmitted to WikiLeaks. So the evidence simply is not there to make those allegations.
I mean, do you have any evidence that it was actually a leak rather than a hack?
We know it was a leak, not a hack. And there's no nothing. The people who have direct knowledge have said all along, you know, this wasn't Russia, it wasn't a state player, it's a leak. Of course, we're not going to say anything to identify sources, but somebody, if anybody wants to say that we're lying, they have to actually produce some evidence. And so far, there's absolutely zero evidence being produced by anyone in their attempts to claim otherwise. The whole Russian hacking story is a total nonsense.
Well, some people would probably accuse you, I mean, I'm talking about the NSA on this side, of peddling fake news by saying that it was a leak. I mean, how this seems to be a term which is being used, really the great term of the new year. It's been actually a bit before the new year, wasn't it? But what do you make of the idea that we're being told that we've got to watch out for fake news, and that people like Facebook are going to have various systems to stop it appearing on social media?
Yeah, no, it's very scary, because what will be accepted as genuine news is anything, put out by the BBC or the Washington Post or the Guardian, and those people have been shoving lies at us for years and appear to be upping the rate at which they shove out lies. The idea that you need gatekeepers and guardians of truth, the idea is, of course, to use the corporate interests that control so much of internet communication, particularly Facebook and Twitter, in order now to control the internet and to do it through them. Because while the internet remains free and there's always a workaround, if you want to reach a mass audience, it's very hard to do it without Facebook and Twitter. And that's quite scary. Now, I've had myself ghost banned on Twitter and various, particularly, as regards WikiLeaks and the emails and this whole Russian hacking business. I've had restrictions on my Facebook account where they've blocked people from sharing and all that kind of thing. So it's happening all the time. I should say there's also, we shouldn't forget Wikipedia. There's also prefigured by Wikipedia, where Wikipedia's set of rules for what it accepts, basically the main, it has to be something published in a book or published in the mainstream media. Which automatically gives a right-wing bias to an awful lot that's accepted on Wikipedia. If it's published in the Daily Mail or the Sun, that's an acceptable fact to put in. If it's published on, you know, one of any number of extremely reputable alternative media sources on the internet, that's not acceptable for Wikipedia.
Now, some say, and I think I'd have to put myself on that list, that there is a tremendous amount of effort to do what we would call, I mean, you might call it fake news, but I would call it information warfare. And a lot of people saying that actually this is a large part of modern warfare, that you're actually there to do psychological operations to get people to believe a particular thing. I just wonder how you think that fits into the whole geopolitical situation with the slow ending of the war in Syria, and it seems a kind of blocking by Russia of any further moves by NATO in places like Ukraine by retaining the Crimea, by holding on to their bases in the Eastern Mediterranean and in the Black Sea. How does all this fake news and psychological warfare, as I will term it, fit into geopolitics for the coming year, for 2017, do you think, Craig?
Well, I think there have been three massive shocks to the ruling elite in the West. The first was Brexit, of course, and the second was the election of Donald Trump, and the third is Putin's diplomatic victory, if you like, in both Ukraine and Syria, where Putin seems to have successfully faced down the West. And I think you put those three things together, and it's really shaken the confidence of the ruling elite, and of course. We shouldn't forget the underlying factors which have caused so much of the trouble the ruling Western elite are in, especially the massive wealth gap, the growing disparity of income, and the decline of subservience. The fact that people no longer see wealthy people as their betters in any way, and the fact that people now despise the political class in large numbers. And, you know, this is a measurable phenomenon. So I think it's quite natural, looking at the broader picture, that they are desperate to regain control. And the first thing they want to regain control of before they can regain control internationally is regain control of their own populations. And to do that, they're desperate to, you know, clamp down once again on control of the media, because part of their loss of control is the fact that media has fractured, and the mainstream media, by and large, is in deep trouble, and alternative media and alternative news sources have been growing. And they've quite rightly now perceived that as a threat to the extent that they are panicking. And in a sense, that's good news. I feel reasonably confident that we'll be able to restrain the attacks on or get work around the attacks on alternative forms of information. And I feel reasonably confident about the future going forward.
Now, in 1943, George Orwell resigned from the BBC because he said, I'm actually doing you a favour by resigning because propaganda doesn't work. He was working on the Indian section, but he was convinced that it was actually a waste of time, a dead end, really.
It can work, you know, to a degree and for a limited amount of time. It's very hard for it to go on working forever. But the BBC is a very effective propaganda outfit. There's no doubt about that. I think, you know, for example, Syria is a very good example where the BBC has pumped out again and again information which is completely false, but has succeeded to a large extent in influencing public opinion, not succeeding in gaining, you know, 100% support for the government line in Syria, but persuading people that a disastrous policy isn't as disastrous as it seems, and that to a certain extent, they have persuaded a certain number of people that, you know, right is wrong and black is white.
Also, finally, Craig, we've got some big moves, haven't we? We've got the interregnum now at the Emperor's Palace over in Washington. In between, and this time next week, will be Trump's inauguration. But in the meantime, Operation Atlantic Resolve, thousands of tanks are moving into Western Europe. Thousands more tanks that were in Germany and Holland in Western Europe are being moved up to the Russian border. And we've also got thousands of US troops as well being flown into the continent. Do you think that this is going to do you think Trump is simply going to take those back when he gets into power, or is this quite an ominous move?
No, I think I know it's not the same, but you know, Putin's far too sensible to do to react in any too hasty or hot or dangerous way. Russia in the long term obviously wants to negotiate for the removal of the newly advanced NATO troops, and particularly the missile systems that have been advanced. Trump will probably hold on to those for a while in situ where Obama's placed them in order to use as a negotiating position, you know, for whatever else he wants to bring out of Putin. All the signs are that Trump will have a much more sensible negotiator diplomatic relationship with Russia, as opposed to this sort of mad Cold War rhetoric we've had from Obama. But I don't expect anything too spectacular to happen in the next week or two.
Because the thing is, I mean, you're saying they had to negotiate to remove the missiles from near to Russia, because back in 1962, it wasn't really negotiation. It was threatening to nuke them that was the only way that they actually got the Russian missiles out of Cuba and the American missiles out of Turkey back in the 60s.
Yeah. No, I think we will I think we will see a, as part of the reset of U.S.-Russian relations, which I think we will see once Trump takes power. I think we will see a negotiated removal of the advanced missile systems that have been recently put into place, or are being put into place, which will be held against some of the other things which Trump wants to get on his side, which are quite likely commercial. You know, it'd be in terms of commercial access of various kinds, I expect. But I'm not. I don't think it will be too difficult or too dramatic to get back to a situation of much greater normality with Russia again.
The trouble is, of course, sometimes war can be good for business.
Well, I mean, that's the whole point of the Obama-Clinton anti-war, anti-Russian rhetoric, is that it. It's been extremely good for the defense industry. And of course, Trump's election, well, one of the interesting things about it, because, I mean, there's no doubt at all that for people with progressive views, some of Trump's domestic views are extremely worrying. The views of his appointees on Israel are extremely worrying. His view on women is extremely worrying. His desire to slash taxes are extremely worrying. But on the international front, his desire to end unnecessary military adventure and to reduce defense expenditure, which he said, you know, is quite cheering. And the share prices of Boeing and other defense-related companies have actually fallen since his election, because people believe there may well be reductions. And that would be a good thing, because plainly, we've had a period of several decades in which the military and the arms industries have been benefiting even more than usual from an extremely expansionist American military and war policy.
Okay, Craig Murray, could you just finish up by telling us how we can follow your work online, and maybe about any books that you've got out?
Yeah, my My website's craigmurray.org.uk, and usually there's something on there new fairly well every day with the odd break, but I try to look at international affairs and domestic policies, and some of it's sometimes quite light-hearted, and other times they're serious and researched pieces. So that's craigmurray.org.uk. My most recent book is Secunda Burns, which is an autobiography of Sir Alexander Burns, British spy and diplomat, explorer, famous figure in the Great Game, who died in the First Afghan War in 1841. And I think, you know, in order to understand the world today, you do need to know where it came from. And what really interested me in researching that book was the resonances of history and the mistakes we make now, which are exactly the same mistakes we made almost 200 years ago.
Yes, amazing to see the BBC talking about their correspondent from the Second World War, who's just died, talking about all these tanks moving up to the border with Poland at the same time as they're talking about the tanks moving up, US tanks moving up to the Russian border, without actually making any kind of connection between the two for some reason. Anyway, former ambassador to Uzbekistan, Craig Murray, thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Thank you. Bye.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Now, Martin, Craig was talking there, obviously, about this problem with this Israeli, not even on the official diplomatic lists, although he's coming under the Israeli embassy. Surely, I'll put the same question to you that I put to Craig. This is actually the security services job, MI5, Andrew Parker, Nosy Parker, we call him, the director of MI5. He's really supposed to make sure that foreign governments are not allowed to operate like this, particularly when they are actually trying to remove British government ministers as part of what they're doing here in London.
You'd have thought so, wouldn't you? But I think, I'm afraid, that the intelligence services have allies and enemies, and MI5 and MI6 are pretty close allies with the CIA and with Mossad, and they've certainly connived with them and with the intelligence agencies of the Gulf Cooperation Council to wreck Syria.
I mean, but surely people
years.
Like Andrew Parker have politicians they have to answer to.
In theory. But in actual fact, if we've got people like this chap running around getting rid of people, giving £1 million to Labour Friends of Israel, goodness me, that's a lot of money, isn't it? You can buy an awful lot of influence with that.
Suppose it's quite feasible that people around the world would look at this and say, well, Britain is just a kind of client state of Israel, almost.
Well, I think there's a pretty clear that there's a very strong, practical operational relationship between the Israeli intelligence services and the Western intelligence services, and the Saudis, actually. And these intelligence agencies, the Saudi intelligence agency, for example, not under any kind of democratic parliamentary scrutiny, but they will have their goals. And all of these agencies have collaborated in the crucifixion of Syria, if I may call it that. They've armed and trained jihadi terrorists from Al-Qaeda to ISIS, and they've turned the place into a miserable, miserable mess.
We hear about terrorists,
Israelis
the whole time.
Israelis carried out an air raid in Damascus yesterday.
Well, this is what the Syrians are saying, certainly. But we hear about terrorists all the time. Almost every day there's some other thing about a terrorist attack here, there. The only thing is that the definition of a terrorist is someone who's not a state actor. They're someone who's in some sort of whatever pressure group that's taken up arms in order to influence a political state in the country. But the evidence is increasing, isn't it, that actually there's more and more state backing for these terrorists.
Much
of that state backing could be from NATO, from Britain, and why not, for example, the Russians or the Chinese?
Well, I mean, in the past, the Russians did support national liberation movements, and the Chinese did. The Zimbabwean African National Liberation Army was trained by the Chinese army in Mozambique. That's true. But the British army, of course, trained Al-Qaeda to fight the Russians in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And then, of course, they pretend that Al-Qaeda is some kind of... We're then told that they're an enemy that we've got to oppose, and we've had 15 years and invaded several countries to defeat Al-Qaeda. But it turns out that James Lemessurier, the ex-British intelligence agent who set up the White Helmets, who are the main propagandists propagandists for the al-Nusra Front inside Aleppo until they were all driven out, they are working as the PR arm of al-Qaeda, who are supposedly our bitterest enemies, except they aren't, because we're running their PR and we're training their militants. And that's all being done at taxpayer expense. In actual fact, the intelligence services in this country are out of control. They're not actually under parliamentary control. And they're working with their allies in Israel to control parliament. That's probably what's going on.
I mean, we've talked on this show many times about the Oded Yinon plan, which was formulated after the Six-Day War, after the Yom Kippur War. And I think it was the Six-Day War, wasn't it, where most of the occupied territories were taken by people like Moshe Dayan, who were the military commanders of the Israeli Defense Force at the time. To what extent then do you think that Britain and the United States are actually complicit with this plan? It's effectively a plan to balkanize the Middle East. I mean, I wonder, because of the things like the Sykes-Picot Agreement. I mean, it was Britain and France that actually drew up this kind of the borders, which actually don't really fit with ordinary tribal and ethnic groups in the Middle East.
Well, they don't, but any attempts to change those borders can also lead to problems, as we're seeing. I mean, it's pretty clear. I mean, in the Arab street, as they call it, you know, on the street in Damascus or in Cairo, people know all this. They know that the British, the Americans and the Israelis cooperate to control the area. And also, of course, are responsible directly and indirectly for the deaths of millions of people. I think we can pretty safely say that. And therefore, as Craig Murray pointed out as a former British ambassador, our reputation isn't actually that brilliant around the world. Why would it be?
Okay, so let's have a listen now to Donald Trump, who was speaking this week. He did his last press conference before he becomes president this time next week, next Friday. And he's got plans, apparently, to transform industry, to create jobs. And also, I found it quite interesting that he's definitely got some ideas about controlling the pharmaceutical industry and the defence cartel. So let's have a little listen to what Donald Trump had to say on Thursday, I think it was, maybe possibly Wednesday, this week at Trump Towers.
We've had some great news over the last couple of weeks. I've been quite active, I guess you could say, in an economic way for the country. A lot of car companies are going to be moving in. We have other companies. Big news is going to be announced over the next couple of weeks about companies that are going to be building in the Midwest. You saw yesterday Fiat Chrysler, big, big factory going to be built in this country as opposed to another country. Ford just announced that they stopped plans for a $1 billion plant in Mexico, and they're going to be moving into Michigan and expanding very substantially an existing plant. I appreciate that from Ford. I appreciate it very much from Fiat Chrysler. I hope that General Motors will be following, and I think they will be. I think a lot of people will be following. I think a lot of industries are going to be coming back. We have to get our drug industry coming back. Our drug industry has been disastrous. They're leaving left and right. They supply our drugs, but they don't make them here to a large extent. And the other thing we have to do is create new bidding procedures for the drug industry, because they're getting away with murder. Pharma has a lot of lobbies, a lot of lobbyists, and a lot of power. And there's very little bidding on drugs. We're the largest buyer of drugs in the world, and yet we don't bid properly. And we're going to start bidding, and we're going to save billions of dollars over a period of time. And we're going to do that with a lot of other industries. I'm very much involved with the generals and admirals on the airplane, the F-35. You've been reading about it. And it's way, way behind schedule and many, many billions of dollars over budget. I don't like that. And the admirals have been fantastic. The generals have been fantastic. I've really gotten to know them well. And we're going to do some big things on the F-35 program. And perhaps the F-18 program. And we're going to get those costs way down. And we're going to get the plane to be even better. And we're going to have some competition. And it's going to be a beautiful thing.
It's going to be a beautiful thing, Martin. But what about, I mean, is he being a bit naive? Is he going into this with some sort of almost like a kind of first grader attitude, which is, yeah, we can sort it all out, but actually it's going to be much more for him to do than he's really going to be able to cope with?
Well, on that very point, I think I take umbrage with what Craig Murray was saying about how Trump will probably be able to reset relations with Russia. There are plenty of people inside the deep state in the US who are determined for that not to happen. And they're quite capable. The Israelis, for example, carried out this airstrike in Syria yesterday. That's what the Syrians are saying, and I've no doubt they're probably right.
But they're already being told it by the Russians, aren't they?
Well, but the point is
that missile came from here. Yeah.
If he wants to make the obvious thing for the Israelis to do, if they want to stop Trump making friends with Russia, is just make war with Syria, and therefore Trump, with his pro-Israeli policy, will then have to support the Israelis as opposed to the Russians. I mean, Trump seems to think that he can talk nicely to the Russians, but he can scream and shout at the Iranians and the Chinese. And in actual fact, the Iranians, the Chinese, and the Russians can hear all of this, and they're saying, "Well, look, these are our friends." You can't, Kissinger and the others are seeming to suggest that we can make nice to the Russians, and then we'll give them a bit of something so that we can make war on the Chinese and the Iranians. But the Chinese and the Iranians can hear this being said, the Russians can hear it being said, and the Russians are very well aware that the president doesn't necessarily control the policy in the US.
Okay, so who is this deep state you're talking about? Who are they, and what's their whole agenda?
Well, I mean, the deep state is just a phrase that people use. I mean, you've got to remember, accept the fact that there is no real democracy in the West. There's no real democracy anywhere, but it's probably closer to a functional democracy in current Russian Federation than we are in the West. And what you've got is a military-industrial complex, intelligence services who are completely a law unto themselves, and they're actually working with very, very wealthy oligarchs. Now, Trump is an interesting character because he is a wealthy oligarch. He inherited most of his original funds from his father, and of course he was very heavily involved with the mafia in most of the places where they originally were, which is why, of course, he's got this kind of capo style of approaching things. You know, we're going to break their legs, blah, 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 which is all very interesting, and we're all having a little smile about it. But I think it's quite feasible that Trump will not be able to set the policy on Russia. It will be set for him, and he will do as he's told. That's what I think will happen.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? But he's been sort of turned around, saying even if he's been persuaded to say it once, it was Russia hacking the emails.
Well, that's the whole point. I understand that there is a mechanism for removing the president if a majority of his cabinet and the vice president think that he's not up to the job. Now, what he's done is he's stacked his cabinet with loads and loads and loads of far-right Republicans. And those people could easily be persuaded to remove him if he doesn't change course on Russia. And loads of people in his cabinet, including the Vice President Pence, they're all saying, no, Russia's an enemy, Russia's an enemy. Mattis was saying it at his, Mad Dog Mattis was saying it at his confirmation hearings. So in order to try and make peace with the Republican Party, he's stacked his government with Goldman Sachs people, military blowhards and all the rest of it. And that cabinet is in a position to remove him. And if he was serious, he would have packed his cabinet with people who weren't going to remove him, who were loyal to him personally, and he hasn't done that. So he's very weak, and okay, I think he can be removed.
So what about these thousands of troops heading for the Russian border? And Trump's defence pick says that the US must be ready to confront Russia. This does sound as if there is, I mean, this whole idea of... And he's accused the Kremlin of plotting to break NATO. This is General James Mattis. Now,
Trump was plotting to break NATO.
No. Mattis is saying that the Kremlin is plotting to break NATO. He's just said this. Now, I mean, you've got accusations anyway. That's what they are at the moment. That the US intelligence agencies attempted a coup in Turkey back in July last year.
That's what the Turks believe.
That's actually, isn't that also potentially going to break an alliance if you do that to the people who other countries that are
in it? It'll be interesting to see how that plays out, because the Turks are moving closer to the Russian position.
And trying to persuade the Germans to confront Russia too? Is that not likely to break the alliance?
Steinmeier, who was the foreign minister, and I think he's favourite to be president of Germany, he called manoeuvres like this that are going on now sabre-rattling and warmongering. The German industrial classes have got a very strong interest in building a positive relationship with the Russians. And they are, in fact, going ahead with building this Nord Stream pipeline, which will bring gas directly from Siberia to Germany without crossing Poland or anywhere else. And, of course, the East European countries are totally opposed to it. The Americans are totally opposed to it. The British are totally opposed to it. The Israelis are totally opposed to it because they're part of the same team. But it's going ahead anyway because it makes absolute sense for the Germans to buy cheap gas from Russia and to build economic relations with them. Well, they live much closer to Russia than they live to the east coast of the United States.
Replacing Kerry as Secretary of State is this guy Rex Tillerson, just been announced on The Intercept yesterday, that he wants to provide Saudi Arabia with more help to bomb Yemen.
Well, indeed. So I don't think people should get carried away with the idea that Trump is going to be much more pacifistic than Obama. All the evidence suggests that he's not. I think the Russians are pretty hard-headed about this. They know what happened at Deir ez-Zor when the RAF participated in the slaughter of 82 Syrian army conscripts. And that was that Obama and Kerry were saying one thing and Dunford, who was the head of the Pentagon, did something else to stop any kind of negotiation from taking place. And if you think about it, things like 9/11, which Donald Trump himself said must have been carried out by bombs on the day, he's right, it was carried out by bombs. And I feel like saying to Donald, you're right about that, Donald, it was done with bombs. And that means it wasn't Al-Qaeda, was it? Who was it? What are you going to do about that? And of course, if you're up against that kind of power structure, it's very difficult for a neophyte like Trump to do anything serious. And I don't think he is. He's a terminally trivial person, I think. No JFK.
Just in the news today here, this is in The Guardian, specific terror evidence apparently is not necessary for the RAF to strike people with drones and kill them. Attorney General says not knowing the target type or time of a terrorist attack should not prevent military action, and that's Jeremy Wright QC in a speech to the International Institute for Strategic Studies.
Well, in Pakistan, where most of these drone strikes have been carried out...
Well, they're taking place in Yemen, of course, too, aren't they?
Yeah, the democratically elected government of Pakistan, of both right and left, have said, will you stop killing our people? That's illegal, and it is illegal. If they did it to us, we'd call it illegal. If the Syrian Arab Army were to retaliate against the RAF for the killing of 82 of their soldiers earlier last year, then they could turn up to the place where the drone was flown from, RAF Waddington, and shoot some of the people in the Nafi. And that would be absolutely okay, wouldn't it? Because it's an act of war.
Okay, finally, Martin, on the moves of all these tanks up to the Russian border, do you think they will be just there for a little while and go home?
They'll be there for a while and the Russians will watch them. But they've got no chance of defeating the Russian army in a fight. If they try and invade Russia, they will be crushed. And of course the Russians have no intention of
attacking them. So what's the point of it then? What's the point?
What they're doing is they're trying to whip up as much hysteria as possible so they can spend more money on weapons, because that's where they make
their
money.
Maybe these tanks are coming past up to their sell-by date. Yeah. Time to sign off now for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Mukawi, thanks to our guest in the first hour, Green Councillor for Froome, Mendip District Council Shane Collins, also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, our sister show Dialects on Tuesdays at noon. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the politics show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
An award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.